But first up this morning, how full is your house? Not of people, but things. Do you regularly clear out the clutter that accumulates in our lives? The junk mail, the plastic packaging, the old clothes that might have become stained or torn? What about sentimental items you've collected over the years? A dress from a high school formal? Gosh, I'd struggle to fit into that now. Photos of friends and family, souvenirs from travel, they're all worth keeping, aren't they? Now, people who live with hoarding disorder, as it's called now, struggle to differentiate between what to keep and what to throw away. For various reasons, as we'll hear, so much so that the clutter takes over their house, their minds to a great extent, and the home they live in can no longer accommodate them or even their families. So the 2014 National Hoarding and Squalor Conference begins today, bringing together practitioners and trainers who are working to really minimise the harm that can come from hoarding, including the effects on children. Three guests are joining us this morning from the conference, but just before he gives his opening address, let me introduce Professor Matash Coles. He is a consultant clinical psychologist, a senior lecturer at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, Sweden. He's an absolute leader in this field. He was also on the advisory panel for the latest edition of the Psychiatric Diagnostic Bible. We've been hearing a lot about the DSM-5, which now formally defines hoarding as a disorder. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well, thank you.
David, your opening address in just a matter of minutes is Hoarding Disorder, the Birth of a New Mental Disorder in the Psychiatric Nomenclature. I mean, this might be a new and distinct diagnosis, but this is not unfamiliar to psychiatrists and psychologists, is it, this condition? This is nothing new.
No, absolutely not. The label might be new, but the disorder or the problem behavior has always existed as far as we know, and it seems to be universal as well.
On what basis was the decision made to classify hoarding disorder as a separate and distinct mental illness? What evidence was brought to bear on that decision?
Well, there's a number of factors. Previously, hoarding was considered to be a part of another mental disorder called obsessive-compulsive disorder, or OCD. But research carried out in the last decade or so revealed that the very important differences between OCD and problematic hoarding. And while it is possible for people with OCD to hoard as a consequence of their illness, the majority of people who have hoarding difficulties do not meet criteria for OCD. And another critical finding was that people who have difficulties discarding do not respond to evidence-based treatments that work very well for OCD.
All right.
So that was critical in the decision process.
So what, under the new guidelines, what actually distinguishes hoarding disorder?
The sufferer with hoarding disorder has profound difficulties discarding possessions, regardless of how valuable they might be. And this difficulty results in the accumulation of so many possessions that their homes are no longer usable. The rooms are not usable for the intended purpose. Mm. For example, people may not be able to cook in their kitchen or sleep on their bed, and this causes a great deal of distress and impairment and social isolation.
Enormous distress and enormous social isolation. What would this distinct diagnosis mean for treatment, and how clinicians work with people with this experience?
Well, it's a fundamental step that we now have this separate mental disorder, because the diagnosis is so critical. Because having a home full of possessions might be the consequence of a number of mental disorders. It could be a consequence of dementia or schizophrenia, even OCD. But the treatment in each of these cases will be different. So it is critical that we get the diagnosis right in the first place. So now, once we know that someone has hoarding disorder, then we know what to do and what not to do in terms of treatment.
Well, just thinking about that, given that you've just expressed that hoarding disorder might be the consequence of a number of different problems, dementia or other psychiatric conditions, do we have a good understanding of who is vulnerable to this disorder? Is there often a trigger, or does it start early in childhood? Is it a predisposition, or is it a trauma trigger?
These are early days, as you might imagine, since it's newly recognized. Research is in infancy, so we don't know very much. We know that it runs in families, and that it's partially heritable. We do not know what genes are involved in it. We also know that there are some environmental factors that might be important, like traumatic life experiences. But we do not know for sure. Material deprivation in childhood, which is one of the factors that people have been mentioning, does not seem to be related to hoarding, actually. So having an impoverished childhood with few material possessions, it does not seem related to hoarding. So these are early days, though.
That is very interesting. The conference you're attending and speaking at in just a matter of minutes is the National Hoarding and Squalor Conference. If you're living with hoarding, does that necessarily mean that you are also living with squalor? Is there a spectrum here?
No, it doesn't. Most people who have hoarding difficulties do not live in squalor. Some of them do, but from the diagnostic point of view, if someone comes across a very squalid property, one can think, start suspecting that this may not be hoarding disorder, but another form of severe mental illness like dementia, schizophrenia, chronic alcoholism, etc.
Is the main therapeutic work, and we're going to meet two people in a moment who do this, behavioural therapy, or is there another approach?
At present, the best treatment we have is indeed cognitive behaviour therapy. The first clinical trials have been run, and the results are encouraging, but modest, which means we need to work a lot harder to develop better treatments.
Is this mainly prevalent in adults?
It is. Most people seek help when they are in their 50s or 60s, but this doesn't mean that doesn't happen earlier. In fact, we know that probably the origins of hoarding disorder are in adolescence or childhood, because almost invariably when we ask people, when did this start? And they say they remember specific events in their childhood or adolescence.
When they started keeping things. We must let you get back onto that stage as you give the opening address to the Hoarding and Squalor Conference. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Professor David Matush-Coles.
Thank you.
And David is a consultant clinical psychologist at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, Sweden, where he heads up a research team focused on, well, obsessive compulsive disorders and also hoarding disorder, which is separate now to OCD, as you just heard. Now let's meet on Life Matters, two people who work therapeutically with those who live with hoarding. Tanya Reid is a hoarding practitioner, as she's been, I've been told she's described, and a trainer from a consultancy for the Crowded House she's set up. She's also written a book for children, quite specifically, who might be living in a house where hoarding is happening. It's called An Ordinary House. Welcome, Tanya.
Thank you.
Great to have you. Come a bit closer to the mic. Also joining us on that very same phone line, Angela Dillon is also at the conference there with David. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
A psychologist and hoarding specialist yourself, let me start with Tanya. You work very closely with people actually in their own homes. How significant is it when a new client actually allows you in that front door?
It can be quite an amazing experience for some people. I've been into people's homes who haven't let anybody in for 30, 40 years. So it's quite an amazing kind of honour, in a way, for people to trust that that they and their items are going to get treated with respect, and that they're taking steps to overcome the shame and the embarrassment, and that they would like some change.
Incredible process at gaining that trust. When you walk in the door of a house that hasn't had anyone else in it for 30 years, what Just describe that feeling and the scene in some of those cases.
They tend to be, particularly for people whose hoarding has been going on for such a long time, the levels of stuff will be quite high. So visually there's a lot usually to look at, to step over. Essentially my work is about supporting people to make their homes safer. It's not about turning people's homes into a display home or anything like that.
Because these houses become a fire risk, and there are some tragic stories around that where people actually die in their own home.
Yeah, and also the impact on children and animals as well. My book addresses the children, the impact of hoarding on children, but I also donate part of the proceeds to the RSPCA as well as the Alana and Madeline Foundation to support those with less of a voice to receive support.
What sort of conditions have you seen children living in? I mean, you've described a little bit of what you see, but what can be the toll on children? Very extreme in some cases.
Yeah. Tragically, a couple of years ago, there was a little boy in Melbourne who, aged five, he cut his foot on a cat food tin. And because his parents weren't really attuned to him, he was sick for a couple of days, and then I think he lost consciousness. And then the mother took him in her arms and walked him to the nearest ambulance station. And that is such a statement around the fear, the complete fear of letting people in.
What was the house like?
It was hoarded and squalor, so it was an awful living environment. And, I mean, it's not always, well, it's not essentially, you know, it's the impact of the stuff as well. That little boy never learnt to walk properly. His gait was quite what we would think was strange because he didn't have flat surfaces to walk on.
Because he was avoiding all the stuff.
Mm.
Did he survive?
No, he died.
He died. Let me come to you, Angela. You have made this something of a focus of your therapeutic work as a psychologist. And I think you have something personal to offer here too, don't you? Because you have your own experience of hoarding. What was that like for you?
Well, I was like a lot of other people with the issue that I didn't think it was really a problem, and that I realised it, because it was becoming an issue for other people, because I lived with husband and then my daughter, and I finally thought, well, yeah, we're not being able to use the place as it's intended. And I think I started to try and, because I'm a psychologist, get a bit of empathy to the people who lived with me. So there were often things discovered I'd sort of moved out of the way for fear of my late husband getting rid of it, throwing it out, and so I wouldn't remember what I'd put where, and it was just to try and sort of hide it, I suppose. And but then you can't eventually keep hiding it; it starts to build up around the place.
And I just want to acknowledge that it takes some courage as a psychologist to admit your own problems, and so thank you for doing that for the benefit of others. What was the trigger that shifted that for you personally?
I think I was sitting there one day thinking, I'm treating people for other issues and using therapeutic methods that highlighted the irrational thinking and the way thinking and beliefs were getting people into trouble in their lives, like, anxiety and depression. And I thought started to dawn on me, some of my thinking was a bit like that.
That's how you work with people, isn't it? You focus on their thinking. That's the very core of cognitive behavioural therapy. That relies, though, on a degree of self-awareness, and I wonder how difficult it is to get people thinking about their own thinking in relation to hoarding. How do you do that?
I suppose you try not to tell people. You do different exercises to sometimes that you do actually use behavioural sort of experiments to challenge, for example, fear of getting rid of something, and rather than tell them, or with the cognitive side of things, do some series of questionings that help try and lead them to the conclusions themselves.
Is it actually about helping them understand their relationship to the stuff, making that transparent?
Yes. And how, you know, how it's getting them into trouble and how they might be thinking differently about it. That's, I hate using the word dysfunctional, but dysfunctional, irrational. Sorry, I'm a psychologist. That's the, sort of the words we use.
You've got to use it because yeah. It is dysfunctional.
It is, yes.
That's right. Tanya Reid, how do you work with people? When you walk inside a house, you're working therapeutically in a sense too.
Yeah.
What do you try and do with them physically and psychologically?
The basis of my work is to find out what they would like to be different. I also come in with like a harm minimisation approach. So if they want to work on things in a spare room, I'll say, well, how about we, because of the risk of fires and falls, how about we work on some of the entry and exit points, getting smoke detectors, having clear pathways. So if you do need to get out in a hurry, that you're able to do that. And I guess essentially it's about supporting people to make the changes that they want. I'm certainly not there to tell them how to, you know, what to keep, what not to keep.
But do they not always know what they want because they're so entrenched in the hoarding behaviour?
I guess, though, if I'm there, if they're letting me in, they're ready on some level for some different type of way of living, for a healthier, safer for them and all their kids or their animals or their partners or... and we certainly know that pulling up with a big skip is one of the kind of most traumatic things that we can do. And, of course, I also work with families and friends. Of course, that's all they want to do. Cause
just clear it out.
Just clear it out. However, in some states in America, they've now banned those big clear outs because too many people were taking their own lives afterwards. It's that traumatic. What it tends to do is that people will resume the acquiring with like a frenzy because we've taken away their identity, their comfort, their source of...
occupation.
Reason. So... I'm very clear I don't touch anything without anybody's permission. It's a process. I mean, it's a process of trust as well. Sometimes I meet people three or four times in a park before they let me into their homes.
And do they initiate contact with you? Or
yes,
has the service initiated contact?
Both. I've worked with doctors and lawyers, as well as people in public housing. This illness affects people right across the spectrum.
And that's vital to make clear, isn't it, that there is no one demographic that's affected by hoarding. Angela, in terms of that comment that Tanya made about people going in with a skip, and certainly sometimes a situation spirals out of control and they end up with a court order for an enforced clean out. Mm-hmm. Such is the toll on them and their neighbours and the street and the community. What's your view on that approach?
Well, I've actually been involved with someone who was taken to court and they delayed the enforcement order and because I went to court and advised she hadn't had any treatment yet for the hoarding issue and to give her more time because she was very traumatised by the thought of people coming in and she, particularly, as Tanya said, touching her things and just throwing everything out and losing stuff, which, you know, might be important to her. And so, I don't think they're a very good idea. Yeah.
Sometimes this takes a lot longer. Tanya, finally to you, just thinking about children, because you've written this illustrated book, An Ordinary House, targeted particularly at children who might be living in a hoarding situation. What can hoarding do to the relationship between a parent and a child? I mean, you gave the example of a very extreme situation.
Mm. Yeah.
What does it mean for a child living in that house?
It essentially changes the roles that people have in the house. The stuff essentially becomes the focus. So the needs of the child are put aside, particularly when children are, say, under 10. As a way of connecting with their parent, they also become involved in the protection of the things.
And the hoarding activity.
you know, children want the approval and connection with their parent, and so that shifts that dynamics. Children don't tend to, won't be allowed to have friends over. And so in our society, we have this reciprocal thing about social. So if I come to your house, I'd like to, then you're expected at some point to come to mine. And so it also affects that social ability and interactions. It affects whether people, kids can go on school camps because the money's is being spent maybe on storage, maybe they're having trouble paying the rent, so the parent might start gambling to recoup that money. Children's nutritional needs aren't met.
So it's really working with those families and their children.
Yes. For children particularly, it's about understanding and talking about the impact that hoarding has had on their lives. Ideally, there'd be support groups for children who, I mean, there's not enough support groups for people who hoard, so nevertheless children. And I called the book An Ordinary House to illustrate that we never know what's going on behind closed doors, and my hope that more homes can return to the ordinary.
Well, we've put a post on a Facebook page about the book. And Angela, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Tanya Reid, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Angela Dillon is a psychologist who focuses on hoarding in some of her cognitive behavioural therapy work with clients. Tanya Reid is a specialist working with families who live with hoarding. And her book is called An Ordinary House. It's written especially for children in mind. It's a kid's book, basically. And the father has a grief experience and starts to hoard, and the child tells someone at school about that. Thanks, Tanya. Mm-hmm. Well, on Life Matters, Natasha Mitchell with you this morning. I'd love to hear from you on our Facebook page, or perhaps you'd like to email us about an experience that you've had of hoarding. We'd really like to hear from you, and you can do that from the homepage.